We all love mob movies. Scarface, The Godfather, the list goes on and on. But there's one movie that speaks to me above all others. Donnie Brasco starring Johnny Depp. In season one of Deep Cover, we discovered the real story behind Donnie's time undercover with the New York Mafia and what it was like spending 6 years with some of the wildest wise guys you'll ever come across. I'm your host, Leo Rossi, and I've spent my life behind and in front of the cameras creating stories about the mob. This season, we're going even deeper into the Donnie Brasco story. We'll learn more about the man behind the persona, Joe Pistone, and his time as the most decorated undercover agent in FBI history.
This week on Deep Cover, the real Donnie Brasco, Joe and Leo have a sit-down with former member of the Columbo crime family, Michael Francese.
Michael Francese grew up as the son of the notorious underboss of the feared Columbo crime family. At his most affluent, he generated $5 to $8 million per week. That's per week from his legal and illegal businesses. Michael masterminded brilliant scams on the edge of the legitimate business world. From auto dealerships to financial services to sports and entertainment to a multi-billion dollar tax scam. We are going to find out how and why he walked away from the criminal life and La Cosa Nostra. Michael, welcome, but I did want to just give you the liberty, anytime you feel, to break my balls, because the fabric of this show is Joe Pistone breaking my balls, and he's made it an art form, okay? Just so I give you the freedom, babe. Joe, you want to introduce Michael?
Michael, Leo Rossi, as I said before on your show that you critique movies, Leo was in Analyze This, and he's been in how many movies, Leo? 105?
Yeah, The Good, The Bad, The Ugly. Yeah, about that. No, it's about 116, Joe, who's counting.
Just a little introduction there. And Michael, I want to thank you for being on. We've been friends for over 25 years now, right?
A long time. And how?
As I mentioned before, I met you in the life, never did anything with you, just had a one-day meeting, not really a meeting, just an introduction. And then about 20-some years ago, we met at a Major League Baseball conference where we were both on the dais talking about gambling. On every show that I hear about you, it's about your, you know, when you were in the life. And you were in the life, but you got out. And that, to me, I respect you for that because I know you're not one of these guys that, you know, found Jesus in a can. You're a sincere individual. I mean, you and I have been on many programs together, given lectures together. So we've had countless hours of conversation, and you are legitimately a legitimate guy. But tell me, and I want the audience to know, I mean, I know about your family man, but tell us about after you got out of the life, about getting married, your family, religion, and the talks you give to individuals about the life, about gambling, just about doing what you're doing, about your faith.
Well, I appreciate that, Joe. And yeah, we've been friends. I always say I'm glad I only met you once in the life. Well, I may not be sitting here now, but yeah, we've been friends over 20 years. And I'm returning the favor because when you sat down with me, I mean, the comments were great. People just loved the interview and both parts, one and two. It was classic for everybody. So I thank you for that and just here to return the favor. Anytime you want me, you know I'm here. And you know, Joe, I got involved in the life, not because I wanted to be a gangster all my life. You know, I got involved because I saw it as a way to help my dad. You know, a lot of people don't understand that. You know, they say, oh, you know, you weren't one of those shoot 'em up type of guys. And I say, no, I wasn't. I didn't get into it.
Michael, can I interrupt you for 1 minute?
Sure.
I know you were actually a pre-med student, correct?
That's right. Yeah, I was a pre-med student, Hofstra University. I was going to be a doctor. That's what my dad wanted. And, you know, that's what I wanted. And then my dad, you know, ended up with a 50-year prison sentence. He claimed to me all the time, Joe, from day one that he was innocent, you know, that I had to help him overturn the conviction. And I love my dad, regardless of anything, you know, he was a good father to me. you know, good father, good husband to my mother. He taught me a lot, and I wanted to help him out. And he thought being a part of the life was a way to help him out. And that's why I got involved. You know, he proposed me back in, I think it was 71. I got made, straightened out in 75. It was Halloween night. I went through that. And when I got into the life, I wanted to be the best possible mob guy I could be for two reasons. Number one, I wanted to please my dad. And number two, when I do something, I try to do it as best as I can. It's just how I do things. You know, and for that time, I mean, you know, I spent well over 15 years. And during that time, I did the best that I could. I got in a lot of trouble. You know, I had 17, 18 arrests. I had 7 indictments. Probably broke a record. I mean, 7 indictments, 2 federal racketeering indictments, 1 by Giuliani. And there came a point in time, Joe, when I really saw the life for what it was. But I say this all the time. If I didn't meet, I meet a young girl, young Christian girl. She's now my wife of 36 years. And if I don't meet her, I probably stay in the life, die in the life, maybe be in jail for the rest of my life. I don't know. But for me, it was a blessing to meet her, because what I said to myself is my family, my mother, my father, my brothers, my sisters, destroyed over my dad's involvement in that life. You know, I mean, you know those stories. Sister died of an overdose of drugs. My brother's a drug addict for, you know, 25 years.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, towards the end of the ugly relationship, my mother blamed dad for everything that went wrong. And I saw total destruction, not only in my family, but a lot of families have made guys. And I said, I just meet this girl. She's 20 years old. Am I going to do this to her? Why would I marry her or get involved with her and then drag her into this life? It doesn't make any sense. So I had to make a choice. Either I accept her and try to make a life outside of this with a family, or I don't. And I made the choice to you know, be with her. And so I'll be honest with you, I didn't want to hurt anybody. I didn't want to put people in jail. I didn't want to embarrass my father like that. I didn't want to put him in a situation, because I knew that, you know, he proposed me. I didn't want to create a bad situation for him. So I did my best to try to get away from that life. And that's why I took a plea. I took a 10-year prison sentence. I had a $15 million restitution. And basically I said, okay, I'll do 7-8 years in prison. I know that. But when I get out, I'll move out to the West Coast. I know everybody's going to be upset with me, but I knew the life really well. I said, so I know how to protect myself. I could have never made it in New York. So I said, let me try out on the West Coast. And, you know, it was a sincere thought when I left the life. It wasn't because I was mad at anybody. I didn't want to take revenge on anybody. I just wanted to preserve my life and that of my family. And basically, that was it. You know, so how I got involved in speaking and everything else, well, that's another whole story. It was the last thing in my life I ever thought I'd be doing. But, and this is how we met, you know. I'm finishing up my sentence. They had me in a hole for almost 3 years. And during that time, when I was getting near the end of my sentence, I had 6 months left, the FBI came to me and they said, look, we need a favor from you. You know, you had this big gambling operation on the street. It wasn't really mine. I had bookmakers working for me. You know how it goes.
Exactly.
I said, look, you know what's happening with our athletes, how you guys are putting them in trouble. They're gambling. I said, yeah, of course. I know the whole bit. Well, we want you to participate in this video with the NBA. They're making an anti-gambling video. And I said, guys, you've been telling me for 8 years I'm going to get killed. There's words all over the street. My father put a contract on me. Persico did. And now you're telling me you want me to do a video? I figured it was a setup. I said, what are you guys talking about? I don't do video. But anyway, I agreed to do it. I filmed the video. I get out of prison 6 months later, and the NBA and the MLB come to me directly. And they say, Mike, this video is really having an impact. They featured me prominently through it. And I told everybody just how we set up an athlete, how we get them in trouble, and what the consequences were. And they said, will you come and speak to our athletes? And that was in 1996. That's how I started speaking. It was really Major League Baseball, the NBA, and the FBI that put me on the road to start this career of mine for the last 25 years.
Well, the FBI, not all that bad, right? Yeah.
No. You know what, Joe? I got to tell you something. You know, I grew up, because of growing with my father, I hated law enforcement. I hated the FBI because I looked at them as our enemies. My dad was very anti-FBI. I thought you guys were like creatures from a different world. You didn't even think like me, act like me. And today, yourself included, some of my best friends are in law enforcement. They're just good people. You know, and we get along. And, you know, I got a friend out here who was the second in command of Beverly Hills Police Department. Now he's the chief of UCLA. him and I are very, very tight. I have friends all over the country in law enforcement, and it's like this whole transformation of thoughts and minds, and the whole world opened up to me, and I'm very grateful for it. Very grateful.
Well, you know, that's a tribute to you too, Mike, that you were able to make those kind of friends, because if you weren't sincere, you wouldn't be able to cement those relationships with guys in law enforcement.
Well, you know, for whatever it is, you know, you get a different outlook. You start to see people for who they are and not, you know, not a badge behind that. Doesn't mean that they're bad people. And, you know, look, I've been speaking up so strongly for law enforcement with all this stuff, crazy stuff that's going on in the street that I totally disagree with. You know, Joe, people will say to me, Michael, you know, you shouldn't be defending law enforcement. I said, really, why not? I said, I have a wife, 5 daughters, 6 grandchildren. When they walk down the street, I want them to be protected. Who's going to do it? You? I said, I depend on law enforcement to protect us. That's the job, and that's what they do 99% of the time. So what are you talking about? I don't understand this crazy mentality anymore. You know, I just don't get it.
Mike, I remember one time, I don't know if you remember this, we were speaking and you were married, you had several kids, and I guess we were feeling each other out. But, you know, I said, this guy and I like this kid. I consider you a kid. I mean, I'm a little older than you are.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, but and the reason why is we're at a big conference, I think a sports deal where we were both speakers, and we're in a hotel, and Michael has his wife and his little kids running around the hallway. I said, this guy I like. We're in a nice hotel, and he doesn't come by himself. He brings his wife and his young kids. That always stuck in my mind. That always stuck in my mind, Michael.
Yeah, I try to travel with them as much as I can.
I don't know if you met Maggie, his wife, but if he don't toe the line, he's going to know it.
You know, Michael's met her several times. He knows her well.
Okay, yeah. Well, but let me ask you something, Michael. You had scams going. We talked about it in the beginning. And when some of the people, friends, ex-friends, whatever, they saw you, oh, now he's found God. What's his scam?
Right.
Were you presented with that with some of the guys?
Always. Even up until now, 25 years later. And Leo, I've spoken probably at over, I think, 1,600 churches in the last 25 years. But people still say it's a scam and I'm pulling the wool over everybody's eyes. And I guess, you know, for some people, I'll take that to my grave. I mean, it's just how they think, you know, it's crazy. But, you know, what are you going to do?
They don't want to deal with what you're doing right now. It can't be all good. There's got to be something in the back. You know, I'll tell you, he knows a friend of mine, Bobby Costanzo, character actor. You've seen him in a million things. Yeah. And I happen, my choice, to go to church every day. Mm-hmm. I, you know, my father did it, and when my mother died, and I followed suit. Mm. So he finds out about this. He's from Bensonhurst. Yeah, you know that.
Yeah.
And he goes, so Russ, you go to church every day, huh? I say, yeah, every day. He says, is that every day? I said, which word don't you understand? Yeah, every day. He said, you must have some kind of guilt, Mo. I mean, that's the way they look at things, you know. But it's really great what you're doing. And my experience, having written the original screenplay for John Gotti Jr., John Angelo Gotti, mm-hmm. I tell you, the guy is a family guy. Mm-hmm. He's got 6 kids. That's his whole life. He's got one kid now as a WMMA or whatever it is, yeah. MMA. Yeah. And I was a little shocked like that, you know, and I'm saying, no, this is for real. And he is not in the life anymore. Well, let me put it this way, and you comment on this. Sammy the Bull Gravano, now he's on different things, and you may have him on your show. Sammy, he did what he had to do. He believed it was the thing to do, and he went into the witness protection program. He served some time, and then he went. And then he gets out with a stipend from the government, and he goes in to the drug business, the ecstasy business. What? And then he does 22 years in prison. Explain that mindset, Michael.
You know, it's funny you bring it up, Leo, because I've in the last several months, I've met with Sammy twice. And, you know, I'll tell you guys what's going on. They're we may come together in this big showdown between Sammy and I, you know, the gangster versus the racketeer, because we have a different mindset. You know, Joe, I'll tell you something, Tony. I mentioned you to Sammy, and he got, oh, how did you do that? Why did you sit down? I said, well, what are you talking about? I said, Joe and I are friends. Well, how could you be friends? This is the mentality. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, what are you mad at Joe for? I said, you're mad that he did his job better than we did ours? Is that why you're mad? You know? And he didn't, you know, he just, that Sammy is Sam that way. But, you know, he's gone on and he said, you know, I don't believe you're in this religion thing. I said, well, Sammy, you don't have to.
You mean as of today,
he doesn't believe it. You know, he came back and explained himself to me, but he did an interview and he said a lot of nice things about me. I like my, but he also said, you know, I don't believe Michael is the religion thing. And, you know, he went into that. And he came on to explain himself. I said, Sammy, there's no need to explain. A lot of people don't believe, but that's okay. I said, I don't knock you for not believing in God. And if you feel that this is a scam, that's your business. You know, I don't care. You know, he's got a different mentality. And, you know, sitting down with him, I didn't know him on the street, Joe. I think I met him once or twice, just shook hands and we didn't, you know. But he's still got that old time mentality. Like he said, you know what he said to me, Joe? Last conversation we had, he said, you still Cosa Nostra. You still took the oath. You're Cosa Nostra. You and me are Cosa Nostra till we die. I said, I'll tell you what, Sammy. Then why don't you and I take a trip to Brooklyn and go say hello to everybody?
Yeah, right.
I said, what are you talking about?
I don't know Sammy. I never met him. But the difference to me is he became a federal witness. You know, you didn't. You didn't put anybody in the can.
Right.
Where, you know, Sammy got on the stand and raised his hand.
There's a lot of guys who, and listen, that's their business if they felt that's what they did. But they're mad at me for saying that I never put anybody in jail. Oh, you're still a snitch. You're still a... I said, look, you could call me whatever you want. That's your deal. All I'm telling you is I never put anybody in prison. That's all I'm saying. And I tell you, and I said, I have a lot of law enforcement as friends of mine, so that makes me even worse, right? But I never put anybody in prison. It wasn't what I wanted to do. And as a matter of fact, Joe, I believe, you know, that the government put me in solitary because, you know what happened? I don't think anybody knows this. They took me, when I was on parole, they picked me up, two FBI agents from California, two nice guys that I really liked. They drive me to Newark, New Jersey, and they're going to put me on the stand to testify against John Riggi, good friend of mine.
John Riggi, sure, I know.
The boss, good guy, good friend. Yeah. The reason they put me on the stand is because there was a guy that gave a 302 that was on my case with Giuliani. He got convicted. He became an informant. And he was a go-between between me and Riggi. And he told the government that me and John were getting a tariff on every window that came into any apartment house in New York, which was true. We had a deal together.
Was that the Windows case?
Yeah, it was a Windows case. So they bring me into Newark, and the prosecutor there tells me, You're going to testify. Here's the 302 that this guy Jesse Hyman gave. You and Riggi were partners, and we're putting you on the stand. And if you lie, we're going to take you down for perjury. I said, well, okay. I said, everything in here is true except for one thing. They said, what? I said, this was my deal. It wasn't Riggi's. Riggi didn't have anything to do with this. I don't know what this guy is saying. So put me on the stand. I'll explain everything to you. But I can't implicate Riggi because he had nothing to do with it. Joe, the prosecutor started screaming at me, yelling at me, you're going to lie to me, you blah, blah, blah. And he called me names and everything. I was so upset. They don't put me on a stand. They send me back to California. And within 10 days, I'm violated and put in lockdown for 3 years.
Oh, man.
Now, I don't want to say that. You know what I mean? And that's how it happened. So,
yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that. I mean, they're not all choir boys, the prosecutors.
No, They were very upset with me, and I believe, you know, that's the major reason. Of course, I fell into a trap. I did some stupid thing that I didn't file my income tax, and they were able to violate me on it. The judge did, but they really came at me after that. So when I tell people, look, I didn't want to put anybody in jail. I said, yeah, I spoke to the government, but I didn't do it to implicate anybody in jail. Don't get mad at me for it. Why are these guys mad at me for that? They get mad when I say that.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, I think there is some jealousy somewhere along the line because, you know, look, I played mob guys. I, you know, it's just a situation where every day of your life, you got to look over your shoulder and you got to scam to get to the next meal and this and that. It's there may be some excitement to that, but I don't see it.
I remember Sonny Black. I used to stay over at his apartment upstairs from the Motion Lounge if I didn't feel like going back uptown. And, you know, you knew Sonny.
Yeah.
Sonny was a, you know, Sonny was a gangster, but
yes,
he had a different mindset. You know, he wasn't in that 24-hour, 7-day-a-week gangster mode. You know, I mean, I used to go upstairs with Sonny, feed his pigeons, and he'd talk about his pigeons. And when I stayed at his apartment, and I think this is one of the reasons why I was successful too, Michael, is I never judged those guys, you know? I never saw them as gangsters. They were just people that were breaking the law, you know?
Yeah.
But Sonny would get up in the morning, go across the street and get our coffee, our hard rolling butter, you know? And we go up and up on a roof. But in some of the conversation, I say, Sonny, you know, this is a tough life. Every day, guys are talking about, we got to do this, we got to do that, we got to make money here, we got to make money here. This guy screwed us, that, you know. And he said, Donnie, he said, it is a tough life. I wake up every morning and I think, am I getting clipped today or am I going to jail today? And I would say to myself, that's a hell of a way to live. But that's what was in his head because, you know, he was the pretty powerful capo during his time. Did you feel that way, Michael?
Yeah. I just, a lot of things that I saw just really rubbed me wrong. You know, I've never said this before, but I'll say it now. My father's main problem, I'll tell you what I believe it was. Before I say that, he used to sit down with me and he'd tell me, Michael, this life is full of shit, which I'm telling you right now. He said, but we took an oath. We got to abide by it. We got to navigate through it as best we can. But he said that to me not once, 100 times. But his problem, you know, the problem with my dad and maybe guys like Sonny, his legacy in that life was more important to him than anything.
I agree with you.
Yeah, you could have hung him on a cross. And I hate to say this because I don't want it to sound wrong. But in a way, he would have sacrificed his whole family for his legacy, not to be known as a snitch or anything. It meant more to him than anything. Him and my mother had a volatile relationship. They loved each other, but it was crazy. Their whole relationship was crazy, right? My mother was a tough woman. She didn't back down anything, right? And I would always take my dad's side all the time whenever there was any kind of dispute between them. And towards the end of her life, I started to understand my mother more. I started to see what she went through, 33 years without her husband, all the challenges with the kids, and she fought for my father's release. And I started to feel so much better about her. And one day I said to my dad, I said, Dad, you got to take some responsibility for the destruction of our family. We were in the jail when we were talking. And he said, no, none of this is my fault. I was framed. If I wasn't framed, none of this would have happened. And I said, but Dad, you weren't framed because you were a doctor, a lawyer, or a priest. You were framed because you were a mobster like me, street guy. Well, that's still not right. I said, I agree with you. That's not, but there's consequences for our actions, you know? That's just the way life is. There's consequences. When you put your hand in the fire long enough, you're going to get burnt. And he could never accept that. Never accept that. And yet he always said to me, this life is totally full of wrong.
It's interesting that you bring that point out because in my research with the mob, there are two guys that always come up, the gangster's gangster. Sonny Francis, mm-hmm. Your father, John Gotti, mm-hmm. Senior. That these guys are gangsters, and they will go down. And it happened. That's exactly the way it ended.
Yeah.
I mean, how many years of your father's life did he spend incarcerated?
40.
Wow.
He died at 103. He spent 40 years in prison. But the last 50 years of his life, you wouldn't want the life that he had. His whole family was destroyed. He spent 40 of those 50 in prison. When he got out, he's totally on parole. His life was a disaster. Mm. I mean, a total disaster. I mean, every one of his brothers and sisters, his mother, everybody passed away when he was in prison. He lost everybody that way.
Michael, was anybody else in the life? Any of your dad's brothers or cousins or uncles? Or
yeah, my dad's nephew, my cousin Tootie, which is his brother's son. And he turned against my father, And I had a whole, I almost got killed over it, Joe. Something had happened, a big thing. And my cousin turned against him. It was a power thing. My dad's best friend for 40 years, Joey Brancato.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, turned against him, you know? And then his other nephew that I don't even know how to straighten this kid out. He was never a guy for the life, you know, but he went to jail on my dad's case too. So it was a couple of them that were straightened out. You know, my dad came to me one time, my brother John. You know, my brother John always had a drug problem.
Right, yeah.
If it wasn't for me and my father, they would have killed him a long time ago. But my father came to me and he says, I want to get your brother straightened out. I said, Dad, are you kidding me? Are you blind? This kid's got a drug problem. You're going to get him killed. I said, I'll tell you what, you propose him. I'm not doing it to my brother. Sometimes I question the thought process. I don't understand it. And not only that, but a lot of guys, you know, and I'm not trying to separate myself from that, Joe. I'm just being honest here talking. Maybe because I got away, I can see things more clear. But I don't understand the thought process of some of these people. I really don't.
Yeah. You mentioned the drugs. When Sonny Black sat me down and told me he proposed me for membership, that was one of the first questions he asked me. He said, Donnie, you ever have any drug arrest? I said, Sonny, no. And, you know, I've never used a drug in my life. And none of the guys that I ever hung around with ever used drugs. You know, of course, it was a different generation, but they may have been involved in the drug trade, but none of them would ever put that crap in their bodies.
I mean, the night I got straightened out, they told me straight out, if you mess with drugs, you die. And I don't know if you remember Tony Augello, Tony Gawk, they called him.
Yeah.
He was a soldier with us. Well, he came to me one time. He got involved in a little drug deal with Persico's son. And he came to me and he said, Michael, I'm in a lot of trouble. I said, what happened? And he said, we sold drugs to an undercover agent. I'm going to get busted. He said, and it was with Junior's son. I said to him, Tony, you've been around this life for 25 years. You're a stand-up guy. Don't worry about it. He says, yeah, Michael, right. They're gonna make me take the fall, or they're gonna make the kid take the fall. I said, Tony, don't worry about it. I'll straighten it out. I was captain at the time. 2 days later, he went into a phone booth and blew his brains out because he said to me, I'm not gonna let them walk me in a room and get me that way. That's how serious the drug thing was. You could not get involved.
Back in the day, yeah.
Back during our time. Now, maybe before that, because, you know, everybody brings up, that Luciano might have been involved. And I said, look, I don't know what happened before my time. I'm telling you, from my time, we were not allowed to deal with drugs. That's it.
Deep Cover will be right back after this short message. And we're back with Deep Cover.
In Bensonhurst, we filmed parts of Gotti with Travolta there.
Mm-hmm.
Then we did a series, which is called Gravesend. Bensonhurst, Gravesend's right next door to it. And they still put mob guys on a pedestal.
Yeah.
They'll tell you about Tony Lee. They'll tell you about JoJo this, that, the other thing. And I just nod my head. Yeah, you know, because I'm playing a bad guy. Okay. So I'm not going to go on any crusade, and I'm talking now that was supposed to take place in the 80s and all, you know, and the cars and everything. This is now. That's what they feel.
Yeah.
Heroes.
Yeah.
I will say your buddy, Mr. Pistone over here, when I started writing the thing with Junior Gotti, right?
Uh-huh.
He calls me and he says, so you writing that thing with that kid, huh? I said, yeah, I am. Yeah. Uh-huh. He said, you still an actor? I said, what the hell you mean? Of course I'm still an actor. He says, yeah, well, don't you actors have to have demo reels? I said, yeah. He said, don't spend your money. The Bureau's got more film on you now. He says, you don't have to worry about that. Because Junior had only been out 5 months, you know? And nobody thought that he was really out or anything like that.
Right.
Back when I was a kid, I saw something, and it was a Jersey Gangsters, called Scared Straight.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it was a documentary. I don't know if you saw it, Michael.
Yeah, I did many years ago. It was well done.
Yeah, many years ago. And they had kids that were high risk, and they bring them into prison and everything. You know, when you give classes and stuff, Do you go after a particular segment of kids?
Yeah, I talk to a lot of gangbangers. When I go into a jail, I tell them I want to be in front of the hardcore guys. I don't want the guys that are, I want the hardcore guys. This is who I want to talk to. And, I do basically the same thing. I tell them straight out. I say, look, you stay in this life, you're either going down, you're going to jail for the rest of your life, or you're going to get killed. It's one of the two. I said, there's no way to continue in criminal life in this country and get away with it. It's not happening. And I said, your best friend sitting next to you now, I says, when the government puts him in a room, one of you are going to crack. The two of you are not going to stand up. That's just how it is. And, the good thing for me, and I say this all the time, is that the mob life has been depicted. The mafia is the head of the class when it comes to the street gang. You know that. Everybody looks at it like we're the top of the thing. So I immediately have credibility because of that platform.
Right.
Because they look at that. And I tell them, listen, I got away from the biggest gang in the world, so don't tell me you can't do it. There is a way. And it's very powerful and very effective. But, Leo, you got to tell them like it is. You can't sugarcoat it. You just got to hit them really hard right between the eyes. And, hopefully it's been effective. I mean, I've been doing it for a long time. They keep calling me back and I keep doing it. So I think we've had an impact, even in sports. I know Joe has had an impact. I believe I have. I still hear from a lot of the players and a lot of people around the league. So you're fortunate when you have a platform that the media has put out there so much that people know about it. But, I'll tell you what these kids, this is what I get, Leo, all the time. You'll appreciate this. Joe, you'll appreciate this. But, Michael, come on, look at your life now. You had all that money. You had all the power. You had a plane. You had the women. You had the best cars. Look at your Goodfellas and Donnie Brasco. I said, but hold on a second. I said, did you turn the movie off halfway? You didn't go to the end of the movie? Who got killed? Who went to jail? Who lost everything?
Exactly.
They don't see that part.
Yeah.
I said, watch the whole movie, not half the movie.
What did Pesci say in that one movie? The judge, you. He was in, what was the one? My cousin Vinny?
Hey, oh, my cousin Vinny. No,
yeah, you. Yeah. Youth is strange, man. Strange.
Youth.
Michael, what about when you go to churches and speak? What kind of message are you getting across there?
This weekend with Pastor Greg Law, I'll be in front of 3,000 men. This Saturday, actually, I'm doing a big men's thing. The theme of this weekend will be accountability. And I tell the guys, I said, look, who you are accountable to in life is going to dictate the way your life is going to go. I said, when I was in the mob, I said, I was accountable to my oath. I was accountable to my boss. And as a result, I was a criminal doing the wrong thing. And I suffered the consequences. Now that I'm out of the life, I'm accountable to God, accountable to my wife and children, people that believe in me that I don't want to let down. So it keeps me straight because I said, look, you can take the boy out of Brooklyn. You can't always take Brooklyn out of the boy. You still have to be constantly accountable to the right people and constantly nourished. And that's what I tell them. Normally, I give my testimony and I say, look, I was as far away from God's grace as anybody could be. I was a knowing and willing sinner. I was a knowing and willing criminal. I can't make excuses. I don't blame my father. I was an adult. I did everything knowingly and willingly. I didn't have a drug addiction. I didn't have any addictions. What I did, I knew what I was doing at the time. I said, now I may have felt bad about certain things afterwards, but I still did it. I said, so if God can save me, and I really believe he has, and Joe, there's no arrogance in that. I struggled mightily with forgiveness. You don't spend 20 years on a street and just think, snap your fingers and everything is over with.
Exactly.
I struggled mightily with transformation and forgiveness. It's not an easy thing. But, once I really got to understand my faith, I started to say, look, this is real. For me, Jesus really died on the cross, forgiveness of sins. And I tell the guys, I said, look, there's always checks and balances in life. I says, I believe in scripture. I says, there's four words that scare the heck out of me when I die and I have to face judgment. They said, Michael, what's that? I said, I don't want to stand in front of God and say, hey, I spoke in front of 1,600 churches. I talked and praised your name and I did that. And God looks at me, Jesus, and says, I never knew you. And the reason is because I did all of that for myself, for my own glory. I wasn't doing it for you because God knows our hearts and our intentions. And so my constant check and balance in life is, who am I doing this for? Why am I doing this? Because I'll be honest with you, I tell people all the time, Joe, and you'll understand this, and Leo, it's good to have a healthy fear of what isn't good for you. I have a healthy fear of drugs. I don't want to try a drug because maybe I like it too much. So I stay away from it. I'm afraid of it because I saw what it did in my family and so many lives destroyed.
Yeah.
And I have a very healthy fear of going to hell. I believe in eternity and I don't want to go there. So
I'm with you, Michael. I'm with you, baby. All the way.
I spent 29 months and 7 days in solitary.
Wow.
And that's not easy. You know, we weren't meant to be solo creatures. We were meant to be social. I learned that. But I said to myself, if this is what hell is like, but 1,000 times worse, I don't want any part of this. And so I developed a healthy fear of things that are no good for me. And I'm not afraid to admit it. I mean, I think it's the truth.
That's upfront, man.
You know, you talk about faith. That's what got me through my undercover operations, and especially this 6-year one. I mean, look, the guys I were dealing with, you know who they were, Michael, Leo, you know, I mean, these guys were gangsters. I mean,
100%
mean guys. And if things had gone against me, they're going to take me in as an informant, right? They're not going to think I'm an FBI agent. So they're going to kill me as an informant.
100%.
But even when I was under, I went to church and these guys knew it. And nobody really cared. But that's what pulled me through a lot of the days. But, you know, you're by yourself. I'm by myself with 10 mob guys, you know. You're not getting out of there. But to me, it was, well, if it happens, it happens, because that's the way the good Lord planned it to happen. And that's the way I looked at it.
Hey, Joe, I got to tell you this. And Leo, I'll tell you this, you know. It was one night, you know the horror of that life, Joe. You get walked into a room, you don't know you're in trouble, you don't walk out again.
Right.
Well, I had that experience one night. I didn't know if I was going to walk out. And when I started to know you, I said to myself, this life is tough enough. Every day you got to think about something. And here's a guy that's undercover that you may not know. Maybe some neighbor spotted you. Maybe something happened while you were sleeping and information was put on you and they checked it out. Every day you faced the possibility of being killed. And these were tough guys that he was with. These were guys that would do what they said they were going to do at the drop of a hat, no doubt. And every day for all those years, it had to be in your head. And I said to myself, Joe's got to be a person of faith, because only God can pull you through that. Because at any moment, you don't even know. You don't even know if somebody outed you in some way. You could be going to a car, a guy in a seat in the back, boom, you're gone. Walk into a room, you're gone. And you had to have that in your mind, Joe. It had to be there.
Oh, definitely. Yep, I definitely did. Yep.
And that's why to continue doing that every day under those conditions, Leo, I'm telling you, that's Joe's.
He's the Olivier of undercover. I mean, I don't know. I still am amazed by it. Knowing him now more outside of the ball breaking, you know, he really is. He's a man of his word, and you can take that to the bank. You know, he's in certain things is a little to the right of Attila the Hun, but you know, that's Joe. What am I going to say? But I you had me laughing. I was watching your movie night, right?
Uh-huh.
And we'll get into that now. But the way you put it, you said, yeah, well, you know, analyze this, which was before The Sopranos, right? And then The Sopranos.
Right.
You said, yeah, so this Capo is going to go to a shrink. And you started laughing. It's like, not in any lifetime would he ever see the next day, you know?
No way. I enjoyed you very much in that film. I only wish you would have given it to De Niro. That's all.
Yeah. You gotta stand in line on that one. It was so funny because you mentioned Joe Vitarelli.
Yeah.
Joe Vitarelli. Well, he and I, we had the same Teamster driver taking us. You know, they would always, you know, Joe and I would be taken to the set, and at the end of the day, we go home with the same Teamster driver. Well, Joe was one of those guys like Bogart. You never saw him light a cigarette, and you never saw him put one out, but it was always he was smoking all the time. And this teamster was breaking his balls. Joe, you know, you're overweight with your health. You shouldn't be doing it and everything. We did a 16-hour day, Michael, 16-hour day.
Really?
We get in the van. Don't you know, the guy starts, the teamster driver. Joe, and Joe says, oh, let me tell you something here. He says, you see what it says? And he held up the Marlboro box. See what it says on the side here? And he says, what are you talking about? He says, talking to Joe Vitarelli about his smoking could be dangerous to your fucking health. That was Joe Vitarelli, man. That was Joe Vitarelli. I will take credit for one thing. That movie, I was in it, and people stop me to this day. What do you think they say? Hey, was it the first thing or the second thing? Right? That's what they stop me on. And, you know, when you're doing it, you just have a feel for it. But that scene was supposed to end with Jelly saying, there's Stevie Beef. And De Niro says, you know, let's go talk to him, to me.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sitting at the table with Harold Ramis and De Niro, Billy Crystal, who I played on the same softball team with. Uh-huh. And I'm a writer, too. So I says, you know, we're missing a big laugh here. Silence, right?
Uh-huh.
And Billy says, oh, we're missing a laugh? I mean, Mr. Comedy, right? And De Niro goes, well, I said, yeah. And Harold said, do you have something? I said, yeah. I said, mob guys from other families, they really hate each other, but they got to make nice in public.
Uh-huh.
I said, and then I had it all written. I had it written on a napkin, right?
Really?
And I had it where it says, there's Stevie Beef, that fat piece of shit, garbage pail, mother. Whoa, that scumbag, scum sucking pig, right? And then De Niro says, let's go say hi. Remember? It was like the biggest laugh in the movie.
Yes.
And then Billy Crystal, my buddy, what do you think? He takes credit for it when he's on a talk show. That's all right. Yeah, what the hell? I don't care.
Michael, you were in the movie business for a while.
Yeah. I actually produced a bunch of movies, you know, way back in the 80s. And it was a different time back then. You know, independent film, we were able to make some money back then. You know, bicycling film. The different parts of the country. We used to put out 200 prints, 250 prints. I had a deal with Vestron Video at the time. I had an output deal with them. And I produced about 30 films. They were all horror films and, you know, all terrible films, except for two of them that I liked. One was called Savage Streets with Linda Blair. Became like a cult film. The one, Nights of the City, that I met my wife on. And then a movie called Mausoleum, which was the first movie. You'll appreciate this, Leo. I sent a guy out to California that was going to get killed, right? In order to save his life, I sent him out to California to be in the car business. He calls me up. He says, hey, Chief. He said, we're going to be in the movie business. I said, what do you know about movies? He says, oh, it's easy. I got a script. And he says, it's going to cost $250,000. He says, send me $83,000 and you're my partner. I said, great. It's a horror movie called Mausoleum, right? P.S., $1 million later, we produce a film that didn't scare anybody but me, right? Because all the money I did
it. I asked Joe the question. Joe, who would you rather deal with? Like the head of a studio or the head of the mob?
The mob.
It's a heartbeat, man. Oh.
I take them to remember Canon Films, Golan and Globus?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So I take the movie to them. I said, look, I spent $1 million on this film. I said, I want you guys to distribute it. They said, okay. I said, how much will you give me? He said, we'll give you $25,000. I said, I don't think you heard me. I just said I have $1 million in the film. I wanted to hang them both out the window. You know, they were.
Yeah. No, yeah. Avi Lerner has taken over for them now.
Yeah, I know Avi well. Yeah. I know Avi well.
Yes, yeah, he's taken over for them. It's a hell of a ride, man. But, you know, when it's done right, like The Godfather, it was like an opera.
Yes.
I still listen to the music on my car, and it was every scene is like a microcosm of a movie.
Yes.
It's got a beginning, middle, and an end. And it's just lightning in the bottle. I'll tell you this one. You may get a kick out of it. Joe and I were producing a film up in Canada, right?
Yeah.
And which was tough. It was a about the mob, and you hear somebody, yeah, well, you better get out. What am I gonna do now? You can't. We had to hire a lot of Canadian actors. That was in the contract, right?
Right.
So Jimmy Kahn's up there, right? and he's in the thing. Jimmy comes to Joe and he says, Joe, I hear you don't like me. What'd I do, right? And he says, what'd you say, Joe?
I said, Jimmy, I never met you before, and I can't say what else I said, but but we became good friends after that.
Yeah, yeah. He leveled it. And you know, it's almost like, you know, when you hear stories about The Godfather, I heard them out of James Caan's mouth. So there's no in between. And he became very, very good friends with Mr. Brando, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one night he said, I'm in my hotel room, we're filming, and I get a call in the middle of the night. I answer the phone, I say, hello. And he goes, Jimmy, this is Marlon. He goes, oh, Marlon, what's up? He goes, did you know that an electric eel has 5 volts electricity in its tail? He said, no, I didn't know that. He said, do you realize I could use 5 of them to heat my pool? Jimmy says, I got to go back to bed, Marlon. You know,
I'll tell you what, though. He was in the show, Jimmy, and he turned out to be, I mean, a great guy. I can remember, well, the first night we had dinner together, and that's when he said, I hear you don't like me. And I said, Jimmy, I don't even effing know you, you know. So then the next day I get a frantic call from wardrobe. You got to come up to Mr. Caan's suite. Why? Well, we're getting ready to show him the wardrobe and we don't know if he's going to like it and we don't want it. So I go up there and he's like, oh, this shirt, that suit. Yeah, that's great. And they were like, oh, my God, you know, they were scared shitless of him. But he was like, yeah, I think that shirt's great. Oh, yeah, that suit. I mean, we had a great time, you know, during the whole shoot. I mean, he just was a regular guy. And, you know, he was a bronc buster.
Yeah.
He rode Broncos.
Really?
Wow. From Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, from Brooklyn. I think Queens, I think. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
Thank you, Michael, 100 times over for coming by, because I got my own bullshit meter, and ain't no bullshit in you, brother. You're the real deal, and I give my best to your wife and your kids, and maybe we'll hook up somewhere. Oh, I can't say that nowadays. Oh, shit.
No, it's okay.
I'm sorry.
Well, I want to tell you, next week in my studio, I'm going to be sitting down with Chaz Palminteri. He's coming to L.A.
I knew Chaz before he was Chaz.
I'm going to sit with him next week.
Bring this up to him. This is great. When, you know, I was doing, I played the bad guy. Blake Edwards was directing the miniseries Peter Gunn with Peter Strauss and everything. Blake Edwards. Oh, my God. Right. So Chaz was playing like punk number two, you know, and I had the trailer and everything, and I knew him from around. He was a good guy, a good storyteller, you know, and everything. So I says, Chaz, I got the trailer over there with the fruit and the cheese, and go stay in there. You know, I got to be here all the time. Oh, no. So anyway, I go in there, and we would have lunch together. We'd get it, bring it in there. So I said, what are you doing? He says, I wrote this play, and I'm doing it at Theater West. Oh, I know Theater West, Cahuenga. Yeah. I said, what's the name of it? He says, it's Bronx Tale. That's a good title. Sounds good. He says, yeah, I play, you know, 25 characters. I said, you're smoking crack. What? You played? And that's how it started. And the rest, as they say, is history. Give him my best, will you?
He
married a gal from Villanova, and I graduated from Villanova.
I will.
Hey, Michael.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us about your new endeavor? You know what you told you.
Which, the television series?
No.
What am I missing?
The restaurant.
Oh, Slices. Yeah, Slices.
Slices.
Slices. Okay. I'll make a long story short. I'm in business with a guy for 35 years. He's a guy I know from Brooklyn, right? And I supported him in a couple of restaurants along the way. So we sold a restaurant 3 years ago. You remember Primo's on Sunset?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
You probably met Tony, maybe you don't know. Tony Riviera is a guy, right? You might have. I don't know if you're ever out there, Joe. But anyway, he sells it. And I says, all right, what do you want to do now? He said, I want to go into the pizza business. I said, Tony, everybody and their brother's into pizza. What are we going to do that's different? He said, give me 2 years and I'll show you. 2 years later, he spends months in Italy, all over the country. He comes back with a pizza and a system that's perfect for franchising. So long story short, we got 8 stores now. I got 2 in L.A. I got 1 out here in Orange County, Dallas, San Mateo. We're opening up everywhere. And we're going to franchise all over the country. So when you're out this way, I got to take you for one of the best. I'm telling you the truth. You know, I'm from New York. I know good pizza. One of the best slices you'll ever have. Guaranteed.
You know, Joe's coming out here. Maybe both of us will come down and we'll break some bread.
Oh, definitely. We got to get together. You got to promise me.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
I will. You know that. Sure.
100%.
All right, Michael. Once again, thank you, buddy.
I appreciate it, Leo. And listen, I love your work. I mean it. I've seen him in so many movies. You're terrific.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
God bless, Michael.
Next week on Deep Cover, we dive into the world of Hollywood on the set of the show Graves End, starring our very own Leo Rossi. Plus, a bombshell change of heart from Joe regarding another notorious gangster. Keep listening to Deep Cover, The Real Donnie Brasco on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. Thanks to our producer, Monique Nethington, sound designer, Casey Franco, and executive producers, Maddie Stout, Rudy Salo, and MBB Media for putting this episode together. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for more Deep Cover updates, plus exclusive photos and content.